All right, why don't we go ahead and start. So welcome to the April edition of the Blue Waters Asia teleconference. The agenda that I sent out the other day is listed here on the slides. For those of you who haven't joined before, we do both we post the slides on the portal for people who want to try to connect up to the AT conference web conference software or join online and follow along as well. Today, we're going to have a guest presentation, so Fayana Chadavala from the team group is going to give us a presentation, the last part of the call on Lustre resiliency and application I/O error handling, or Lustre high availability. Giving a background of what the Lustre looks like on Blue Waters, and then kind of point of view of the application developer. All right, so we'll start off with recent Blue Waters system events and updates. As many of you know, we're under maintenance right now, and I thought I'd just give you a heads up, a brief overview of what's going on. We have Jeremy Enos in the room as well, and typically admins for Blue Waters to answer some of your questions if needed. But basically, while it is an extended outage, we are making a modest update to the supporting software for Lustre servers. It's not necessarily the Lustre server version itself, but it's the supporting software on the Crave connection boxes that make Lustre run well from the point of view of the server. That's an ongoing process and will take most of the day. There's some other hardware as well going on concurrently. Point of view or from the concern of people who are using GPU codes, we do have a small NVIDIA firmware update that's supposed to be transparent to the user, but we do know that some people do check in whatever firmware is running on the system, so some of you do notice when these updates happen, so I'd like to make them known to the user community. This is something that is more from the point of view of node health checking, and that certain jobs were able to put some of the nodes into a state where the job cleanup wasn't happening properly. So Crave works with NVIDIA to identify an issue in the firmware. There should be no change in functionality or performance from the user point of view. It's something that was preventing certain jobs from exiting cleanly, from the supporting processes from NVIDIA from cleaning up the job properly. So the job had exited actually, but it would be some of the supporting processes for the GPU that were not cleaning up properly. And also, after the maintenance is done, some of us will be doing some testing of some hopefully features coming down the line of topology or scheduling. We've been actually doing that for a while. Had a few test periods, and of course, coming up in a couple hours, so we're excited to see how that goes. And hopefully that's something that will be available maybe in the next quarter, perhaps, or something like that, Q3 probably. So we're excited. Hopefully that'll work well, and a lot of progress on that testing. Are there any questions about the maintenance that's been going on recently? I think we had a review of some of the maintenance items from the previous maintenance session. So lately we've been having maybe almost monthly maintenance periods. All right, if there are any questions about system events and updates, we did highlight during the last user call an upcoming change that we've had some requests for both externally and internally for availability of a small amount of nodes for short debugging jobs or also for smaller IQ job as well. So we've made available a daily reservation. I forgot to include the hours here, but it leaves from 9 to 5 for 180 XE nodes and 64 XK nodes. They're set up primarily for debug, but the IQ will also be able to utilize those jobs as well. If you have a job that fits within a 4-hour IQ or 30-minute debug queue, you'll be able to utilize this full reserve node. So they'll be returned back to the full system after the daily reservation is over. If we do find that this is making it difficult for some of the substitute jobs to run in a timely manner, we may temporarily pause the reservation, but we don't feel it'll make a large impact due to the small number of nodes. But we do monitor when large jobs are put in the queue. We have a job that needs 99.9% of the nodes available, then we'll accommodate that request. So hopefully that will improve turnaround time. So we'll see what we can develop. So it's a new feature that will, I think, hope is documented on the portal, but I'll double check. All right, any questions about the recent change to the queue policy here by adding a small number of reserved nodes as part of a daily reservation? It's something that we had similar early on Blue Waters during the early system science. Kind of a similar idea that this is a little smaller scale.
Right.
So Victor asked, this does not change policy for using the debug queue. It's just a pool of nodes that can be used for a larger job as well. Primarily it's designed for smaller jobs, but it will contribute to a larger job. So it doesn't limit how many jobs, the size of the job in the debug queue, which is hopefully improve the turnaround time for smaller debug jobs. One thing it won't do is, and many of you have mentioned this, it doesn't improve the time it takes for a job once you submit it to be recognized as a job that's eligible. That's a function of the MOAB iteration time. So that's something that we're actively working with Adaptive on, changing system parameters and trying to improve that quality of service, but this will at least make sure that once MOAB considers your job as eligible for scheduling, that it will happen quickly. All right. Another item we've mentioned before is the Darshan IO profiling library. This is something that we're going to make default, hopefully this month. The plan is to put it at the end of the month. We'll fault in the user's environment, so we urge you to test your application if you're interested in doing I.O. profiling. It really helps us to understand how the system is being used, allows us to do some performance analysis and also some debugging during system events that are I.O. related, and so we'd really benefit from having this default. We've tested it with the applications that we have access to, the PREP process or from other users, but we feel that it's really important library that we want to have made default in the user's environment. It would only come into play if you rebuild the application after the module is made default. So if you have an existing application, if you don't rebuild that application, it won't. The library will not profile that application. We do have a setup so that you can also unload the module if you need to, if it causes a problem. we'd like to know if it causes a problem with your application. We've only identified a few small cases where it is a problem. So hopefully we'd like to make that default, and we'll announce that when it's default without a week notice. Okay, are there any questions for people using Darshan? Or people who are thinking about using Darshan? Okay, good. No questions? Hopefully when we enable the default, we can unknown problem. Let's see, so we're quickly moving through the list of agenda items here. This is our monthly request for science success stories. We have Trish Parker in the room here. She's always interested in knowing about upcoming science success stories. If you have an important publication that's been accepted, being ready for publication, or even if it's coming down the road and it's something you want to get some early press or information put out about, if you would like to know about that information, you can contact me, you can contact Trish, you can go to the portal, click on the share results section, you can contact Trish that way. Kelly?
I might add that I know people are submitting information for the symposium, so we're looking at all of them. I might be contacting you to follow up on some of those things to create articles. funnel all of those kind of back as well.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Trish. One thing to highlight, and we've been noticing that most teams are pretty good about acknowledging Blue Waters, especially if you have a PREC allocation. But we just like to make sure that both the ACI number and acknowledgement for Blue Waters, and if you're in a PREC team, that you get your OCI award number in your publication. It really helps us to identify accurately when a publication, if we're not aware of, when we see a publication get pushed out and has that information in it, that really helps us track what's going on with the results that you're collecting from the system. Right. And as Trish mentioned, the Blue Water Symposium is coming up. So we're a month away here in Champaign-Urbana. We look forward to seeing you all here. We've been contacting people about getting short abstracts for the agenda and also about getting extended abstracts for the booklet that will be published as part of the symposium. I think we're doing well. We hopefully should have the agenda fleshed out in a day or so, and that'll be posted to the portal, I think, probably maybe by tomorrow, I hope. Brian, do you think that, Brian, do you think by tomorrow, the agenda? We're working on it. It's close, so we'll hopefully get that out, and we'll send out an email. Shelly, we'll send out an email. All right, so we're close, and we hopefully won't have too many conflicts with time slots for speakers, but we'll hopefully we've been asked about getting that available, that hopefully really this week.
And why have we been asked to have our presentation submitted a week in advance of the conference?
We are trying to be very efficient with time. We're going to put them all into one set of presentation materials so that we don't have to swap between PTs or bring up other files. So that gives us enough time to put them together so we can efficiently go through the presentations without taking much time in between.
It doesn't seem like a week's worth of work, and we have many things to do, like get final exams, grade them.
We appreciate you trying to hit that deadline and make it efficient. We don't want to have to take presentations are relatively short. We're 20 minutes. We don't want to take 3 or 4 minutes each time we switch from one speaker to the other.
And we will have things set up, so hopefully the presentations will be made available to the attendees during the presentation, during the time of the symposium. So that'll cut down on the time it takes for us to get things uploaded and available to all the attendees.
So some people will be using Keynote.
I don't anticipate a problem, except we just have to make sure that we have adequate support for that. Let me think, I guess the alternative would be, is that because you have certain animations? Is there a situation where you wouldn't be able to make a PDF because of embedded animations, Jim?
I think that's the situation. I mean, Klaus uses Keynote for everything. He's got a lot of stuff embedded in that doesn't transfer well.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll bring that up with the person who's handling the audiovisual support, and we'll see.
And also, good luck on the 1 week thing.
Yeah. We'll do our best. We have to set some kind of deadline, otherwise, you know, we would be guilty of letting things slip as well.
So, Greg, yeah, this is Tom from Utah. Can we still update that 2-pager, and when do you need that update by? Because there's a few things I'd like to fix up.
Yeah, I believe we can still have that updated for a while. I don't know when the actual hard deadline is, but sooner is better. So if you have some changes you want to make, please let Calvin know.
Okay.
Okay, great. Let's see, we're all going to highlight the Even Blue Water Scaling Workshop. I think there's a deadline coming up, May 1st, for people who are presenting at the workshop. I don't know if Scott's not here, but it's going to be August 14th and 15th. It follows Of course, you get a lot lately, and a lot of scale computing. Since a lot of you do the large data work, Bluewater understand about the data operations that you do and how that works well with, or doesn't work, the different architectures available. So there's a lot of ideas, topics that can fall into there. I have noticed other workshops, May, et cetera, that are big data operations, if I can work. Kind of getting drowned out a bit of the traffic and the noise, so I can figure it out. So if you know someone's interested and they don't know, they're not aware of this opportunity, please recommend colleagues. Another thing we like to have is the Virtual School Computational Science and Engineering Center. Yep. That will be during this multi-day event. The first one is the Introduction to Programming. That will be June 15th to the 20th. And then the Data Summer School is the 32nd. And NCS will be site for one out of
your audio is about half silent all the time now. I can't hear anything you're saying.
Uh-oh. Okay. Maybe it's that this is a lot more, hopefully, because I'm not seeing any congestion issues. Is that sounding better now if I lean over like this, or is it still dropping?
Much better.
It's choppy? Okay. All right. That might be an issue with campus's link system for
speak up loud.
Right. I've never been told that I've not been loud enough, but I'm going to try to be louder. We have those two events coming on. They're remote site type things that Exceed likes to host. So we'll be hosting a local site here if you're interested in traveling, and we'll have people from NCSA and Blue Waters as technical assistants, local instructors, I guess, in a way. And, of course, for other training opportunities in the near term, check the Exceed website as well. We'd also like to highlight the Exceed conference that's coming up July 13th through the 18th, and we'll be having a couple people from Blue Waters have some papers there attending the conference in Atlanta. So we're hopefully going to, if we see you there, please come over and try to find out if the Blue Waters representatives are there. I guess the deadline is past you, that was quite a while ago, but it should be a good conference. Future topics, if there's some particular topical items of interest that you want to discuss, we're always welcoming topics that we haven't contemplated or thought about. Really, if any limit to what we would consider, so please drop us a line and let us know. All right, so next is Kalyana Chalabhata, and do we want to try to share? You want me just to...
Yeah, have it done.
That's it. Let me make Kalyana the presenter here real quick. Yep, good. We're good to go. All right, fine.
Okay. We thought we'd share some of the design and architecture of the Lustre file system on Blue Waters and also some of the observations from some PDAC teams on Blue Waters. Sometimes there is some confusion as to if there was a problem with the code or with the file system or the system, and it's kind of hard to figure out what went wrong. So we thought we'll share some of the information and observations we had, and hopefully it'll help with running applications on Blue Waters. Just a quick overview, high availability of the Lustre file system on Blue Waters. There are many components. You might have heard some of these terms earlier. OSC, or the object storage target, is the actual disk to which Lustre writes to. This is made up of several disks in RAID 6 configuration, which can tolerate up to two disk failures. So end users should never see any interruption due to disk failures. And these disks are hosted by what we call as an object storage server, or an OSS. It's essentially an I/O server that hosts.
Everyone try to mute. We're getting a lot of background noise. Please make sure your phone is muted. Thank you.
So the essentially an object storage server holds and manages a bunch of OSCs. Failures of an OSS are protected by an active failover pair. When an IO server and OSS encounters issues, the disks that are managed by that storage server are transparently failed over to its peer, and the end user application should not see any issues in case of OSS failures. We also have the metadata components called the metadata target and the metadata server. One is the disk and one is the management service. The disk is again protected by RAID 6. Up to two physical disks can fail, but it will still be available. And for the service of the metadata server, we also have a passive failover pair where if one MDS fails due to some issue, the other one will take over from there, and the user should not see any problems. The other component is the LNET or the Lustre networking. This is sort of an abstract component. It actually is run over InfiniBand and the Gemini networking, in a physical sense. And these are protected with a 4:4 active-active failover pair. So if something should happen to one or more LNETs, the peer LNET will take over, and again, failures are protected. If you see in the illustration on the right, it shows roughly a high-level diagram of how the connectivity is. You can see the OSS and the MDS components, and the squares on the top or rectangles on the top, those are the LNET forwarders that transfer data from the Gemini network onto the InfiniBand network, which connects the disk to the frame mainframe. So the failover pairs you can see are sort of like the green and blue are a pair, and the yellowish orange and the pink, I guess, are another pair. So if one pair or one or more in those groups encounters an issue, the other pair will take over. So we look at some possible failures and available recovery paths. Should the high-speed networking fail, there would be no recovery, and as you know, it's a major event and which would result in some downtime, which doesn't happen too often. And in case of Pythons, which happens generally when there is too much traffic on the network, it sort of pauses, releases the network pressure, and then moves on. In this case, there could be cases where the application might see some sort of an interruption. Failure or not depends on how long the quiescence lasts. In general, the application should not see any failures unless there is a timeout. Various components within the Lustre stack have set timeouts where they would consider their services are probably disconnected. So should the quiescence last too long and a timeout gets triggered, the client, which is your compute node, or in case of if your interactive session, the login node would be evicted from the Lustre configuration, and that would result in an error which would go through some sort of recovery process. We'll look at that in the next couple of slides. In case of an OSS or an MDS failure, as previously illustrated, we do have high availability failover, so all the clients would detect the failover was taking place, and they would wait till the failover is complete, and then they would go ahead from there. So if a failover happens, you will see that your I/O may be taking too long, or you see that your requests are not returned immediately, but it would not return an error. Essentially, it will pause everything, hold everything till the failover is complete. In case of disk failure, which is OSC or an MDT, we think it's a very low probability of more than two disks failing in a given RAID group, and we have not seen any failures in this category so far. In case of an LNET failure, it is possible that the clients get evicted, and rerouting will take place through the next set of routers available for reaching the set of specific disks. Okay, what actually happens in case of a failure? So if an MDS fails, the detection is, again, a timeout, and Lustre also does what is called as a health check. It essentially sends pings to various components at periodic intervals. If there is no ping response, that's when the timeout gets triggered, and corrective action for an MDS failure would be that it would try to connect to the standby MDS and replay last few transactions that have not yet been committed. In case of MDS failure, application should not see any errors, and it may seem like the metadata operations are taking a little longer. What it's doing is it's actually waiting for the payload to be completed so it can reinitiate some of those requests. In case of OSC failure, again, it's detected by various communication problems. And the client for that one specific disk, so on your compute node, essentially there is a client for every disk that the application is using at that moment. The client for that specific disk will enter recovery. That means that you're writing to one OS, multiple OSTs, and one OST starts having trouble, the other OSTs will not be impacted at all. Only that client for that specific OST enters recovery and blocks IO to that disk until the recovery is complete. In this case, also, the application should not see any errors at all. Only the request going to that specific OST will take longer. Right. What could be possibly fatal failures in this number of scenarios that are possible? Client eviction. This is what happens when a client fails to communicate in a timely manner to any of the OSS or the MDS requests. So in order to maintain the state of the entire cluster, the cluster can evict one or more clients and go on without those clients. It will just assume the client is dead or having a problem, and it will revoke all the logs that are issued to that client and moves on from there. So that is what is called an eviction. And client is no longer connected to the target, logs and caches that are issued to that client are flushed. Unfortunately, a client can never figure out that it was evicted. The only time it realizes that is when it tries to do an IO operation or sends a ping, cluster would respond back saying, hey, you're no longer in this cluster, you'll have to reinitiate everything. Again, these are very rare. It depends on several issues as we described earlier. However, when a client eviction happens, you can actually see in your application with the failure error code, which is typically an EIO or E-shutdown. EIO stands for IO error, and E-shutdown stands for transport endpoint shutdown, either of which can indicate that there was a more fatal error talking to the last component. So possible triggers to cause an eviction could be in network quiescence. If this causes timeout to be breached, then the client will be evicted. Sometimes during warm swaps, you might see this, because during warm swaps, the network configuration will be sort of paused and refreshed. And there could be some unknown bugs that could be causing this. In this case, we would try to reproduce it and wait for a fix. Right. In case of LNET failures, again, this also can cause fatal condition for applications. It can cause RPC timeouts. Requests on Lustre are sent using RPC. So if a specific request does not get a response, it can lead to an eviction. Again, application will see an error. However, if you handle the error, you can move forward, because by the time the eviction happens and then it reconnects, it might have reestablished the LNET routing. Again, bugs could be causing some of these issues, but we haven't seen too many of those here. Right. User experiences. So we collected a few notable feedback and application issues that we have seen in the past few months, and Todd will present them here so you can implement some of the techniques in your applications as well. I guess this should not be a surprise. Most users do not implement IO error handling. They sort of take it for granted that when you issue an IO, it is always guaranteed to complete successfully. For Fortran, the failures are very visible, because the application will crash in case of an IO error. However, in case of C or C++, it's sort of a silent problem. If you don't actually check the return value for your read or write, the application will move forward, and you won't see any immediate failures. However, later when you go back and sort of look through the data that you generated, you might see missing pieces or corrupted files, which could cause claims of file corruption, which would be a much bigger concern, but again, we haven't seen any of those happening at all. So we did some experiments with our internal system just to validate some of these assumptions, and our architecture to see what happens in case these failures happen. So all the failures we tested here have been manually triggered, and we looked at how Lux ran the application's response. In case of an OS's failure, as we expected, the application did not see any error messages, and it continued. And IO took a little longer because it had to wait for the failover process to complete. In case of an LNET failure, as we said, we have groups of four, and we turned off several of those in the same group. And in many of those tests, the client never saw any problem. However, when we turned off three out of the four available LNETs, the client was evicted with cannot send after transpoint and cannot shutdown, which would be the e-shutdown message. They repeated it with, again, various combinations of how many LNETs failed. Repeating with one failed LNET, the job survived, and in one instance, job received an error. So LNET failures can potentially cause applications to see an error in case of failures. So we recommend error handling and defensive programming techniques. For Fortran, you have to handle the error if you want your application to continue in case of transient issues on the system. You can use the IO stack to look at the runtime error message and use it in conjunction with the ERR branch specifier. Essentially, it would be the error handling subroutine in case something happens with your IO request. For C++, you have to check the return values for all the IO calls. And of course, there are a number of values that can be returned from this call. So look at the ones that are potentially fatal, and rest of them you sort of can handle in a more generic fashion by just, if it's not success, wait for, you know, maybe 30 seconds and then move on. I wanted to share a quick example here. One of the applications, the user ran a pretty big job, and it completed successfully, and then when he tried to look at the data that was generated, he sent us a ticket saying that the file was corrupted, which caused us quite a bit of concern because we haven't seen any file corruption issues. So when we looked at his job and went back and looked through the logs, we noticed that there was a full disk and he was writing to a full disk, and none of his writes succeeded. However, he didn't check for it. So it continued, and the job exited cleanly. So such issues can be easily avoided if you at least check that the write call has successfully completed writing the amount of data you asked it to write. Of course, this is a corner case because it's not very typical for applications to see a full disk. However, if you are writing on with a strike count of one, and for some reason that one strike ends up on a pretty full disk, then you can run into this issues. So again, we ask you to handle specific errors that you would be interested in. Basically, just at least make sure that the call has successfully completed writing the data you asked it to write. Especially in case of writing, if you ask it to write, I don't know, X number of bytes, it can actually write less than X number of bytes and then return an error code. You have to handle that depending on error code. In case of others, especially that are caused by a network python, you really don't have to do anything other than to maybe wait for a short period of time. Essentially, you're waiting for the network condition to clear out and then retry the call. So you know, make intelligent decisions after looking at after receiving an error code, rather than not checking at all. Any questions? So I know it's pretty high level. Hopefully, it was useful, at least in handling some of these common conditions.
Hi, Charlie. This is General. So are you basically saying that some of these errors are just, or these slowdowns, they're just going to happen, and In some cases, there's really not the option to make the IO operation try again. Like, once it fails, is there any way, like, to, for example, in the case of, like, high network traffic, is there any way to allocate the job in such a way that will, like, is there a different way to do it so that will be minimized? Because, or is it just, we just kind of have to deal with this every now and then?
I wouldn't say that the slowdown just happened. One example of a slowdown could be that every Tuesday and Thursday we do one swap, which is we essentially take out some plates and put back, essentially replace quality hardware. During the one swaps, we do have to sort of quiescence the network just so that the rerouting can happen. And this is a very short reconfiguration phase. However, it has the potential side effect of maybe causing an issue if you are doing I/O exactly at that time. So it would be hard to sort of predict that it would happen during a specific warm swap, but we have seen some applications experience failures when warm swaps are going on. However, we also have modified the code of at least one user to handle that specific case, that when he sees an error, he actually sleeps for, I think, about 30 seconds and retries the I/O. This is a Fortran code. And he hasn't had any problems since then. So it is definitely possible to retry a failed I/O call.
And it might actually be more useful to put wall clock limits into the code itself. And if something is hanging, causing it to hang, you know, if it just hits the wall clock limit, then just exit gracefully rather than waiting for it to be killed. That might be a better way to approach it.
Yeah, in case of if a failover has happened, that's essentially a fault tolerance, and the failover can take reasonably longer time compared to, you know, sending messages from one node to another. So that is a noticeable slowdown. However, failovers do not happen on a daily basis or even a weekly basis. It's a pretty rare event. So if a failover does happen, the fault tolerance will prevent your applications from just dying just because failover has happened. And depending on various parameters, that failover can take a little longer. I think our threshold is around 40 minutes. What was that? Around 30 minutes. So it's not that that long of a time, but yes, I understand. You know, in that case, your application can hit the wall clock and can be terminated. But hopefully you're doing checkpointing so you can restart from the last checkpoint. And again, at the same time, having fault tolerance is better than having no fault tolerance at all. So if because of the failover, maybe 10-20% of the jobs hit the wall clock and terminated and others continued, we look at it as a positive outcome, and I hope you will agree to that.
So this is Tom Quinn. I've got CC++. And frankly, I find the try again errors extremely annoying. So, you know, I ended up writing wrappers around all my F-writes so that it tries again. But wouldn't it be nice if the system handled that? Because, well, first of all, I have no idea how long I should wait. So in my wrapper, actually, I don't wait, right? Because I don't know what's going on with the system.
Mm-hmm.
So why can't the Lustre library just wait for me?
It's actually not a Lustre-specific issue. Even if you look at the POSIX read-write calls, no I/O is guaranteed to complete, even in ideal conditions. You're always required to check the written code and handle appropriately. So, yeah, I want to make it clear it's not a Lustre-specific issue, but it's just the POSIX specification doesn't guarantee the call to be completed, regardless of the circumstances.
On the other hand, I've only encountered this with Lustre file systems.
Sure, yeah. Others are, I would say, more less complex systems. It's easy, you know, if you're this falls out of a single system, then this falls out, and there's nothing else you can do. However, in case of BlueWater or other file systems, there's always high availability built in, and some of these slowdowns and return values can be caused while a failover is taking place or some components have failed and others are taking over. So for us, a complete failure would be when you cannot move ahead at all, whether it's because of network connectivity or some other issues. But if you're able to handle a large number of failure scenarios and then move ahead without taking down the entire system, that's definitely a preferred outcome. And I understand that could be one of the reasons why you would see this only on large distributed file systems. I guess if you go back a few years and if you try it on NFS or something, if the NFS server died, that's end of story, right? You have to wait for it to come back. However, now we have an opportunity to sort of handle these failures dynamically and then move forward without much of manual intervention. And wrappers are a good way to go. So one of our colleagues actually did sort of a library that would retry for you through compiler wrappers. There are several ways to approach this. So whatever is flexible for you, and if you need some help from us, then we can help you with doing some of this error handling. Yeah, even none of the I/O libraries, whether you're using HDF or NetCDF or doing NPIO, none of them do retries. They all depend on the lower layers, including the POSIX layer, to do the I/O for you. So there is no sort of concept of retrying, whether it's the Lustre protocol level or even at any of the I/O libraries. It essentially is a specification-driven implementation at this point. And one reason why the Lustre cannot actually retry is in case of an eviction, essentially all your locks have been revoked and your entire cache is flush. So the I/O is not in sort of the same state, and retrying can cause consistency and coherence issues, and you know, it can also cause file corruption. So it's better to say, hey, I cannot do this anymore, you have to retry, versus retry and cause some bad outcomes.
All right. Are there any other questions regarding I/O handling for Kalyana? Yeah, so thanks. I think we had a good discussion there. You know, it is probably, besides the high-speed network, it is, you know, one of the more shared resources on the Blue Water system, and definitely if everyone uses the system in a good way and there aren't any sporadic hardware issues, I think we can assume that the performance and the functionality is consistent and is well-maintained. We do get cases where users are doing something that isn't in the best interest of the file system, especially as a shared resource, and we are actively trying to monitor for that and try to actively prevent that from happening. And that's one thing that Darshan will let us do as well. So we have monitoring behind the scenes, and then we're trying to have monitoring from within the application to make sure that at least everyone's playing fair with the file system and we're not having issues that kind of go against the best practices for Lustre. Okay, I don't think we have any other comments from people on the call or in the room. And I'd like to thank everyone for attending the April user call, and we'll have the next user call in May. We look forward to seeing a lot of you folks at the symposium, those of you who are coming. And we hope it will be a good and productive symposium for everyone. Okay, thank you very much.